Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
If you're constantly on the hunt for a good deal, then you need Rakuten. Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop because members get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, traveling, dining, and more. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while you're doing it? It's a no-brainer. Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million members who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cash back really adds up.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 887. This episode brought to you by Sony Pictures Classics presents Brigsby Bear, which is a new film starring Kyle Mooney of SNL, Mark Hamill, Greg Kinnear, Matt Walsh, Michaela Watkins, Claire Danes. It is a cornucopia of all-stars. And so it follows the story of James, who's a bright yet sensitive young man, and he's obsessed with this show called Brigsby Bear, and the show gets canceled. He decides that the show absolutely must go on, so he kind of goes on his own Brigsby Bear adventure, and so you should go see it. Brigsby Bear starts Friday, July 28th. It's in New York. It's in Los Angeles. It'll be coming soon to a theater near you, and it opens nationwide August 25th. So thank you to Brigsby Bear for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Let's see what the cork board has in store. Oh boy, this is where I need sound effects. Is that me fishing around for a corkboard? No, doesn't really work. Corkboard! There, that'll work. Mike Craghead writes, I've always made my thing, but at the ripe old age of 46, hey, that's not old, I finally consolidated all my non-lucrative creative enterprises into a home-brewed site that feels warm and fuzzy to me. 3D pumpkin carving, sand sculpture, music, graphic design, and other stupid Mike tricks. He calls them all at MikeCraghead.com, and please note that it is Crag, not Craig. Oh, that poor guy. That has been the bane of his existence, is having to explain to people that there's not an I in the middle of his name. Mike Craghead. Craghead. He says, I can't see myself quitting my day job because all this stuff is very non-lucrative, but maybe I'm proof that you don't have to stop doing a thing that brings joy to you and or other folks just because it doesn't pay rent. Please take a look. Hope you like it. Thank you, Mike Craghead. There is no I in Craghead. Kind of works, actually. Patrick Malloy writes, hey, I've been listening to Nerdist since I was a big cubicle cluster of corporate lawyers who all listened to the Nerdist podcast while we reviewed corporate contracts. And on the day of the Jenny Wade podcast was released, several of us were questioned as to why the entire cubicle section was laughing, wanted to share the story. Anyway, oh, Jenny Wade's the best. So funny. Gotta have her back on soon. Anyway, my second novel, Shadows on the Bayou, was recently released by Bedlam Press. It's a spooky novel about a hitman who was pulled from retirement for a simple mission in New Orleans, but he quickly gets wrapped up in pulpy New Orleans voodoo. It's like John Wick meets Indiana Jones, so who wouldn't love it? You can get anywhere books are sold. Fantastic, Patrick Malloy. And also, maybe you were able to actually do your own contracts. Huh? The law degree paid off. Nice job. Nice job to both of you. This episode is 80 Bryant, whom I adore. She is a brilliant comedy genius. She is on Saturday Night Live. She is also the star of Danger and Eggs, which is the show that half my company, well, it's half my company. I don't want to say my company because it's also Shadi Petosky's company too. So if I say mine, I don't want you to think I'm saying it's mine. I mean, Shadi is the genius who does all the work over there. And I just get to kind of stand back and watch cartoons being made. So when I say Puny is mine, I don't necessarily mean that I'm doing everything. It's really Shadi who deserves the credit and her team. But AD is brilliant. And this was a delightful chat. She came to the house on a day that I had off from the At Midnight program, which is ending soon. I know. One more week and a half of that show, and then August 2nd or 3rd, I think, is the last episode. Anyway, I've now made this about me, and this is 80s intro, so I'll get back to that at a later time. But not too much later, because we only got like a week and a half. But 80 Bryant, Danger and Eggs, is an amazing, gorgeous children's show in the way that like SpongeBob is a children's show or Adventure Time is a children's show. But it's on Amazon Kids, and Amazon's been great and they've been supporting the show, and we had a great panel at Comic-Con, and Shaddy brought all this original artwork from the show, and there was a signing, and they gave it away, and we had a super fun panel, and we gave away hundreds and hundreds of pieces of original art from Danger and Eggs, and so it's been really great. The show is amazing and gorgeous and inclusive and funny and really different, I think, than anything else is out there. So give it a chance. It's on Amazon Prime Video, Danger and Eggs. There you go. And also, you know, write and rate and review it if you can, hopefully positively, because that stuff really does help, you know, particularly with Amazon, that helps ensure that we might get to make more of them. And I think it's a great, important show. So I would love to be able to make more. So that's that, AD Bryant, this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, also brought to you by Blue Apron. For picnics, potlucks, dinner parties, barbecues. Good food is an essential part of a successful summer. And now it's easier than ever to create delicious summer meals with Blue Apron. Less than 10 bucks a meal, they're going to deliver seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients right to your door. You know, I got this for my mom because my mom loves to cook, doesn't love to shop, but she loves to cook. She's amazing at it. And so I got her Blue Apron. I'm like, hey, this, you might like this. And she's hooked. So they're amazing. Just to give you an example, July meals include seared chicken, creamy pasta salad, summer squash and sweet peppers, creamy shrimp rolls with quick pickles and sweet potato wedges, fresh basil fettuccine pasta with sweet corn and some peppers, chili butter steaks, Parmesan potato spinach. Check out this week's menu. Get your first three meals free with shipping by going to blueapron.com/nerdist. You're going to love how good it feels. You're going to feel involved in the process. It's healthy. It tastes great. And those meals are home cooked by you or someone close to you. That's blueapron.com/nerdist. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Here's Nerdist Podcast number 887 with the brilliant AD Bryant. Katie, please.
Now entering nerdist.com.
Scared of birds, and so that, but I mean, not in a way that's debilitating. I can handle it there.
This is a turkey. This is an oscillated turkey, and so it's really colorful.
I mean,
it's way too cold with that open.
It's freaking somewhat, pretty.
Somewhat damper this. Thanks. Yeah, we spent about a year restoring this house.
No way.
I don't understand how microphones work. If I just talk, okay, so it's been about...
Perfect, yeah.
We spent about a year renovating this house, and we're only the fourth owners, and the second owners lived here for about 50 years.
You're the fourth
owners? We're the fourth owners, and the second owners lived here for 50 years, and then they did a bunch of old people shit to the house, apparently, so they put linoleum floors down. Almost all the wood was painted white except for in the dining room.
Jeez.
And then the house was abandoned for a couple years, and then these two guys came in. They were partners. They came in and spent 7 years like raising the house from the dead.
Hell yeah!
But then they did a lot of kind of cheap stuff to it, so we kind of went
like
in
corny.
And got like a little. It's like Pier 1 countertops, and so we sort of went in and. But they really did. They revived it.
I mean, that's cool.
But we kind of went in and did all the this room was completely white.
Yeah, and no, so this is so much better.
We had to bring the wood back and put in the wallpaper. And
I would make everyone work from my home. I would never leave. I would just be surrounded by my big turkeys and just always in my home.
Well, in New York. This is about the size of an apartment in New York.
This is twice the size. No, I'm kidding. Totally.
It must be amazing to. Did you already live in New York when you started doing SNL?
No.
Or did you move? Were you in Chicago?
No, I lived in Chicago.
Yeah.
I was just a woman eating hot dogs and like cruising around the town. I didn't know what anything was in New York. So, I mean, basically, I knew Vanessa Bayer beforehand. So, sort of when I knew I was moving to New York, I like asked her, I was like, where do you live and can I find a place near there, kind of. So
but that's
kind of
a dream scenario, though. It's like, getting to move to New York to do SNL is like the best possible scenario.
Yeah, but it also like it very much, I was in a constant state of like diarrhea at that time. Like the most constant furious diarrhea for like 2 months.
Just for the fear of the job?
Totally. Because, it was just scary. Are we like, have we started?
Yeah.
Oh, we've started.
We're in it.
It's happening.
We're already doing it.
I thought we were just hanging.
We are.
I mean, we are.
We're just hanging. It's just
a
hang.
Hanging.
Don't worry about these.
But I guess I just will not rip apart everyone I know or something now, I guess.
That'd be really funny if you just went through system piece by piece the things that irritate you about every cast member.
Also, not just public personas, but like people in my family.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
stuff
yeah.
That
like
I can,
really private.
I want to go deep.
Things. The childhood traumas, people who wronged you.
I'm going to rip it up tonight.
Yeah, just tear it all up.
Just destroy my life here in front of you.
I mean, you could if you wanted
to.
It's
no.
That easy.
No, it's better to not.
Are you sure?
For today, we'll leave it at maybe the next time I
come. Don't you feel like, though, it would be kind of fun, just for some extra press, to rip open a wound.
I'm always looking for extra press.
Rip open a wound, say some things, Shia LaBeouf it a little bit. We'll call it the Shia LaBeoufer. That's the Shia LaBeoufer is this sort of the distance between your reality and sort of a heightened reality of dramatic life instances.
And I think of myself as the female Shia LaBeouf.
I've often
of
wondered
the industry.
Good. Okay, so I'm glad you said that because I that's something that I think everyone has been feeling.
We're on the same page.
They see a lot of parallels between you and the choices that Shia LaBeouf
100%.
Has made. And so I think it's good that you embrace that. Now we don't have to dance around the topic. We've gotten right to the heart of it. But I do think that New York can be such an amazing place. But it is also an organism that you have to figure out how to navigate.
You have to, learn it.
Yes.
Like, I remember even when I went, I think I was there to audition or I was there for a meeting early on, early in the process of auditioning for SNL. And, one of my agents or managers or something was like, meet me at this place. And I looked up the address and I was like, well, I don't know how to get there. I'm just going to take a cab and go. And I literally took a cab two tiny blocks. I just didn't understand what New York was or how it worked in any way, shape or form.
Oh, I could. Because there was a walk.
I truly was like, I would have never made it.
Did the cab driver give you shit?
He fully was like, are you okay? I think he felt bad for me because clearly I was afraid. But
Mr. Cab Driver, I just got here from Chicago. Take me to the center of New York.
I know. Also, it's not like Chicago is country bumpkin town. But I truly was just totally freaked out in a way where my brain didn't work.
The old game of city mouse, city mouse.
100%.
Those two mice would just be arguing about fucking pizza.
Totally.
It should be thin. It should be thick, you asshole. You can really discover a lot about people by, it's interesting to me how pizza has become a fucking political argument that people will have now.
I know, and especially because people know I've been in New York and Chicago, they're always like, what do you think? And I'm always like, I just like pizza and I don't care. I don't care and I want to eat pizza forever.
By the way, why do you have to... It's not like someone goes, you can only pick one sushi roll you can only pick one burger. Sometimes thin crust is great.
Yeah.
Sometimes a pie, Chicago-style pizza is great.
Totally. Also, I'm unafraid of, microwavable pizza.
Those are fine, too.
I'm open-hearted.
You know what? Maybe one night Ray's, another night Bagel Bites. Who gives a shit? Why do we have to pick?
The thing is, we all like it.
There's nothing wrong with why can't we come to it's just another thing that people can argue about online and shame each other and create tribalism and and create superiority over. I guess it does serve a purpose.
Yeah.
Have you ever eaten at Two Boots?
Oh yeah.
They opened a Two Boots here in Echo Park.
Oh, baby.
Yeah.
That's good.
It's nice.
That's
it is
the
really
bomb.
Nice. Because LA isn't really known for
The za,
or really any particular kind of cuisine, or
I
any
feel like
kind
of... avocado toast. I think of as a hot LA scene feast or
but
something.
But doesn't that feel like something that maybe started in Portland or Austin?
Yeah,
and
you're
right. And then a hipster bit someone, and then it outbreak
yes,
style
totally.
Bled its way through.
100%.
Yeah, and there's hipster living in the woods, and they got to come in and trap it like a monkey, and keep it from spreading the avocado toast.
They gotta.
The Swingers here in LA is a diner that has avocado toast in it. And I mean, it's good, but do you understand the phenomenon behind it? Is this just smearing avocado on a piece of toast, or is there something more to it that I'm not understanding?
I think the thing about it is, like, then what do you put on top of that? So right. It's like some people are putting like little sprinkled nuts or like little oils or something. Right. And I'm a full dummy, and like I've fully bought it where I'm like, I gotta just eat this around the country.
Maybe we should just, I don't know. I feel uncomfortable ordering it because I feel like
it's like a scam.
It feels weird. Yeah. Like maybe we should call it douchebag pizza.
I know, but I love douchebag pizza.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for acknowledging that and then using the term immediately.
I mean, come on. It's in my Chicago way.
I guess it is. In the 90s, I dated a girl who was Australian, and she had got me hooked a while on, she would slice avocados, put it on toast, put a piece of cheese over that, and then a little bit of red salt and a little bit of lemon pepper.
Come on.
And it was pretty fantastic.
I mean, that sounds great. That's the ultimate 90s Australian girlfriend treat.
Yeah, that's me basically saying I liked avocado toast before.
I know.
Yeah, that was very hipstery of me to say
No,
that.
But you're honestly cool.
No, I don't feel that way.
I feel that way.
Oh, I appreciate that. So New York has been kind to you since you lived there after the taxi debacle? You feel like you...
Well, now
you didn't run back to Chicago, obviously.
No, I like it now. I mean, but it definitely took me a minute because I was like, oh my God, I can't handle this.
Right.
But now I really like it. And like, I get that feeling when I come back where I'm like, oh, this is home, like, you know, in a nice way.
So. Yeah. What was your, I always love finding out what the people's SNL audition process was.
Yeah, it was scary and bad. No, I mean,
it obviously worked out.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was good. I mean, I feel like I got very lucky in that I was like performing at Second City doing like, you know, they do like kind of 2 hour long like sketch review type shows. And so you write that show with like you and your five buds and you perform it for like 6 months. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was like the show that I had written with my friends and I had lots of great stuff in it. And it just so happened that like one night Lorne and all the producers came to see it. And
did you know they were going to be there?
Yeah, they told us because, oh, okay. I mean, there was like a lot of audience participation and it would be a living nightmare to like, I don't know, be like, excuse me, sir, can we get a suggestion of, oh, no, like that's Lorne Michaels. So they told us. So then, I mean, I feel very lucky in that like he saw me do a 2 hour show in my home turf with like a nice 300 person audience,
God, that's
as opposed
awesome.
To like just rolling up for like a 5 minute audition in a room with like five people in a, you know.
Can I get a suggestion for the audience? No.
Yeah. Right? Like a true nightmare. So after they saw that show, they were like, okay, we want to fly you out, you know, bring us a hot 5 minutes, baby. And so they had kind of asked that I do stuff from that show. So that was kind of nice because I was like, okay, I know what I'm going to do. It's stuff that I'll get from the show. And so I went and did 5 minutes. And then they flew, like, basically for every 3 days, I flew back and forth between New York and Chicago for, like, a month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I went back and forth, like, 4 times, I think. And basically I had, like, a meeting, and then they had me do another 5 minutes that was – they were like, can you write a whole new 5 minutes real quick tomorrow?
If we give you 10 minutes, can you write 5?
Yeah. And I was like, sure. And I did that, and then they flew me back for one last meeting, and that was, like, with Lorne, so.
And what did he say?
God. Well, he was very nice, and he was kind of just, like, asking me questions, and then at the end of the meeting, he was like, well, and also during the meeting, he was kind of, like, negging me.
What?
In a way where, well, he was like, you're very young, and, because I was, like, 25 at the time. And so he was like, you're very young and you have a lot to learn and it's very overwhelming here. And so I was like, wait, does that mean like I'm coming here or what is that? Like, do you know what I mean? And so then at the very end, he was like, but I think you'll do very well here. And I was sort of like, does he mean later when I'm older or like now or what does he mean? And so then when I like walked out all the producers, when I walked out of his office, all the producers were like giving me hugs, but I still like kind of.
No one said the words.
No one said like, you're hired and we need you here in a month.
Right.
Or like, no one said that. And so I like hugged the producers and then just like walked out the doors of 30 Rock and into my hotel. And I sat on the floor in my hotel room and then was just like deep breathing and feeling diarrhea begin.
Of course.
And then one of the producers called me and was like, you seem like you weren't sure, but you are higher than, like,
oh,
you know.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, thank you.
So you just didn't have an anxiety moment and just grab someone and go, just fucking tell me what's happening.
100%. I was like, yeah, you can play it cool, girlfriend. Just chill in your hotel for a minute. You may or may not have a life-changing experience coming your way, but just kind of cruise in and sit on a weird white bed and, you know. But so that's what I did.
Well, and then did you immediately go back to Chicago and just like pack it up?
Yeah, so what is weird is, and this is how it is for most people, that when you get hired, you pretty much can't tell anyone because they really are trying to save it, to release it.
Of course.
When, like, you know, when they want to. So I couldn't tell really anyone. I told my parents and my boyfriend at the time, and then I make it sound like he's not my boyfriend now, but he is. He is.
He's not with us.
He passed. He passed right on by. I told them, and then I basically went to Second City and I was like, hello, I will be leaving the show next week. You need to get my understudy.
No reason
at all. And they were kind of wise to it, you know, because I had an understudy in while I was going back and forth. And so I did like a week of shows at Second City that were super emotional because the whole time I was like knowing that I was leaving to go and do this thing. And
right.
I had my last show, which normally at Second City you have like a big last night. And so only my cast kind of knew, and we all just like cried our way through the sketches. I'm sure it was a nightmare for that audience. I'm sure they were like, these people are dying this week or something.
But inside for you, you're thinking, I am immediately better than everyone here, and I won't ever have to talk to them again after
Well,
this.
Certainly. I was yes, like, you guys course. Are garbage, and I'm a queen.
It's when you didn't pull the – you could have pulled the, let's see, how do I get out of this in a way where they're not going to know, and you just throw a fit?
That's
you know,
right.
I am sick and tired of you hogging the scene and you stomping
God.
On my – I'm
One of my
done.
Last sketches, I just grab a microphone and I'm like, and by the way, you're all in the dirt.
And scene.
Yeah.
And then that's pretty much it.
So then I basically went to New York and like lived in a hotel for a couple weeks until I found an apartment.
Did your boyfriend at the time also live in Chicago?
Yes, he did. And he basically, I was like, you got to get rid of our apartment and I'll be in NYC, baby. So that's
Have fun.
Yeah, pretty much.
Put all my shit in a bag and send it on out.
Literally what we did. Although I did sort of feel like a 14-year-old because I kind of called my mom and I was like, can you help me get a mattress in New York? Like, I'm scared. And so she did, like, come and help me.
Oh, that's really sweet,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, I know. It's nice.
And now you're old hat. You know how to take cabs.
No, you said old hat. I'm old hag.
No,
but it was like, yeah. And now I got it going on.
Everything's good.
Yeah, it's easy breezy.
Did you immediately find did you feel like you fit into the flow of the show right away, or did it take you time to understand?
You know, it's so weird because I was just thinking about this the other day because I feel like my first season I was like, I'm fired. I'm dead in the water. Like, this is junk. But then when I look back on it now, I'm like, oh, I was having like a fine season like pretty much from the beginning, you know, and definitely in the beginning I was just like so hard on myself. So but now when I look back, I'm like, geez, I was in the show a lot, baby. I should have been living it up.
So what advice would you give for anyone who's coming on to SNL who's new now?
I mean, I always say to the new hires, I'm like, you're going to want to like just beat your head in with a hammer and be like, I'm garbage. But because it's just so overwhelming and it's a system. It's like this train that's been running for 40 years and you have to like figure out, how can I help this train move?
Right.
Like, you know, I'm not a conductor, I'm not a wheel, but where can I go in all of this? And it takes a little time and you have to like kind of get the lay of the land. So, but I think there's this expectation that like you get there and you knock it out of the park, and it does, like, it takes a minute. So you just kind of have to be patient and like try and do your best.
Did the stage dynamics feel the same from doing Second City in Chicago? Or was there a learning curve? Because, you know, when you're used to being on stage, you're used to being on stage, but every room kind of has its own slightly different dynamic. And then when you add television to the mix,
yeah,
and there's cameras in between you and the audience, that creates a slightly different dynamic.
Well, I mean, that was, I mean, I literally had never, like, been on television, been in front of a camera, like, done anything like that ever. I didn't know about, like, hitting your mark, even really. Like, I didn't know anything, you know? And then there's this added weird layer, which is the cue cards, which is kind of a thing that, like, doesn't really exist anywhere else. You don't, like, no show that I've ever done has been like, and you'll be reading off pieces of paper
right.
that a man will hold for you, you know.
You've probably never seen, there's a chance you've only just seen this an hour ago.
Totally. And there's, like, all the mechanics of it are really counterintuitive, where, like, you would think that you should be grabbing a line and then looking at the person, but really that's what makes it look like you're reading, because you're looking back and forth,
right.
whereas you should just keep staring at the cards, and it seems wrong, you know, to do that, but you kind of, that's, like, what you're supposed to do, so that just, like, takes a lot of practice and stuff. And I was really lucky that my first season I overlapped with Bill Hader and Jason Sudeikis and Fred Armisen and Keenan. I mean, it's still here, but, like, they really were good teachers about, like, here's a way to make it look like you're looking at the person, or this is a game show, you can really stay locked on the cards, or, like, you know, just kind of teaching you the mechanics of it that are so complicated, and on top of it, you, like, want to be funny.
Right, you right, know? Right, right, right.
So that's the stuff that, like, is equally overwhelming when you get there, because it's just like, oh, how does this work? This seems crazy.
Yeah, I guess it would be sort of like operating a piece of operating like a massive industrial robot exoskeleton to move a bunch of large industrial pieces of iron around, and then on top of that, you have to tell jokes.
Totally.
you still have to figure out how
to do
your time.
Well, there's so much like almost old-timey showbiz stuff of it, where you're like, You know that in this part of the sketch, they're going to cut to Keenan, but unless you lean out to the left, your shoulder's going to be in the shot. So, like, just remember when you hear, like, Keenan starts to say his line, like, slowly, weirdly lean, you know, and then it's going to cut wide, so you have to be back, like, standing normally or something. It's just, like, weird little mechanic stuff like that, that, like, if you were shooting, you know, a regular film or something, or a TV show, it's like you cut around that stuff or you get it from a different angle.
Right.
And you're doing that live. So you're doing all that technical stuff live, which I think is, that's why sometimes when there's, like, scenes with tons of movement or tons of, like, you know, stunts and stuff that's happening live, like, the technical aspects of it are insane, you know, but it's, and you're trying to be funny. It's
at, like, the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're figuring out, you have to focus on timing, and there's a million things that are designed to throw your timing off.
Including, like, occasionally having, like, just a stranger who's the most famous person you've ever met, like, right by you or something, you know.
Breathing on your face.
Where you're just like, oh, okay, and that's Drake, and here we go.
Hey,
and, like, you know, or, like, you know, whoever. It's just such a kind of a bizarre thing where you're like, okay, my life and my comedy depends on the words of Miley Cyrus.
Hey, Tom
right
Hicks,
now.
Let's go,
yes.
Make some comedy out
totally,
there.
Totally, yeah.
What if we did that?
So it's, on many levels, it's like a weirdly, it's a nightmare and a dream.
has there been a sketch or something that you thought was like, oh, this is a dumb throwaway, no one's going to get this, that ended up becoming something more?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question.
Because I always feel like there, sometimes when you over-engineer something and you go, this is going to be the hugest,
yeah,
it doesn't connect as well. But then sometimes when you're not really overthinking it and you go, oh, I don't know, I'll just try this. And then that becomes a thing.
You know what? We did, like, in my first couple seasons, we did this sketch a lot that was Cecily and I, that was this, like, girlfriend's talk show thing. And where she kind of plays, like, a popular cool girl, and I kind of play, like, her dork friend who's trying to keep up. And I was super, it's such a simple sketch that, like, I was sort of like, this might not stand a chance because it doesn't have all the, like, flash and pizzazz of, like, some other sketches. It's just super simple. It's like a relationship-based scene,
right,
you know, which I feel like sometimes those things can be harder to get away with on SNL because it's, like, pop. Crazy celebrity,
you like a,
topical.
You need like a David Pumpkins sketch where they're like, whoa,
yeah,
hey.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this was kind of just like two girls hanging out then that's it. And it, I was really surprised that, like, people really responded to that, and we got to do it a bunch of times in a row, and, like, that was, I don't know, that was kind of a weird, like, it was a good lesson of, like, you don't know what works here. Like, anything can happen if you just, like, try and follow what you think is fun and funny, you know?
Have you gone back to Second City to do any shows since SNL?
Yeah, I have. I've done, like, a lot of charity shows there and stuff, and a couple little, like, you know, I'll pop in and do the set.
Yeah, of course.
Whatever,
yeah,
you yeah. know? But, yeah, you know, it is weird because now when I go back, I know less and less people, and it's, like, it's all turned over from when I was there, which is kind of wild.
It does feel like going back to your high school.
100%.
I used to sit in that chair.
Totally.
And I was fucking class president.
Well, and like, I'm sorry that everything in this interview is revolving around toilets for me, but like.
No, please.
I always am like, I want to use the backstage bathroom. I don't want to use like the public restroom.
Audience members come in. Is this part of the show?
Oh, fully. More where I'm like, I like go to watch this old Second City shows, and then at like their what is it called halftime intermission, I'm like, I think it would be cool if I went backstage and peed in my old pee hole or whatever. Like, that's like what I'm nostalgic for.
This is only for performers.
I know. I'm like, I used to, guys.
I peed in there so many times.
In 2010 I was all over this toilet.
You know the claw marks on the wall next to the toilet? It's a long story, but I made those.
Oh my God, truly, that is like, I get nostalgic for, I guess, my comfort places.
Yeah, I haven't been back to, it's been quite a while since I've been to UCB on Franklin.
Really?
But the back of the bathroom in the back there, like there's graffiti on the wall that I know I wrote.
Yeah.
So I would almost feel like, yeah, okay. And I would over-describe all the details to prove
totally.
That I should have access to go back there.
I know. I feel that way 100%.
But
I don't know.
Sometimes it, you know, it just, then you just look crazy.
I know. trust me, I know.
But it must be kind of fun to, it must have been maybe weirdly not off-putting, but when you have gone from, you know, just doing this in a bubble, basically, in Second City.
Yeah.
Then you're on one of the most popular shows on television, a legacy comedy show.
Yeah.
And then you go back and people are like, I know who you are. Like, that's got to feel strange a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely weird. It's bizarrely weird. And I feel like SNL is one of the only shows in the world where, like, you know, basically, it's like a switch flips and everything's different. And it's not like, I think it's different than if you just get cast in like a sitcom and then that show has to like prove itself and then you slowly kind of like maybe make a name for yourself. It's like the second you're hired before you've even performed, people are like, who is this and what are they doing and how'd they get in this club? And like, I want to know what's their deal. And
right.
like, you know, that is like a weird, overwhelming thing because you're like, oh, I haven't even done anything. Like, give me 1 minute and I'll try something and then I might, let me see, you know. So there is like a lot of, it literally changes overnight in a way that is, I think, kind of foreign and weird, you
right.
know.
Right. Well, you're under a little bit of a microscope all of a sudden.
Well, people have a lot of ownership over the show because they like grew up with it the same way I did, you know.
Right.
So.
And then do people ever sort of do the, oh, this season is like when Sandler, so it's a little bit of Sandler and it's a little bit of Farley, you know, it's like there's
totally.
Always going to be the, I mean, it's hard not to, I did Red Nose Day and we shot a lot of it at Studio 8H.
Yeah.
And when you just go down and I mean, I've been watching SNL since it first ever aired. So I'm just sort of going through and being like, oh my gosh.
Look yeah.
When you see how much history is involved, it's hard to not get freaked out. I was just freaked out about it. I was only there for an afternoon.
Yeah. It is, well, you know what is an added level to it is that the people, all the people that you work with at SNL, so many of them have been there for 25 years or 30 years. Some of them since the very start of the show, you know? And so you're working with costumers who are like, yeah, I used to like dress Molly Shannon or, you know, like Maya Rudolph and all these people. And so you're kind of like, and I'm a size 8 shoe. And like, you know, you just, you feel like, the history all around you all the time in every way. Like, we all have, you know, dressers and people who help us with our quick changes. And I'm always like, who did you have before me and stuff? You know, I want to get the dirt. So
are they cool about talking about that stuff? Are they like,
totally, yeah.
We're just here to work, sweetheart. Just put on these shoes and get out there. Get your shoulder out of the way.
No, they're really good. They're really good. They definitely let it, like, indulge us in our questions and stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
No,
yeah.
It's the coolest.
I would drive people fucking nuts because I almost, when we were doing our shoot, I almost felt like a tour guide because younger people didn't recognize.
Oh.
There were certain cast members. I'm like, that's Terry Sweeney. He was there when Dick Ebersol did the show and Lauren wasn't, you know.
Totally.
So it's like I know a lot. I know a tremendous amount, like an annoying amount of SNL history. And it's, I mean, there just isn't really anything else analogous to it.
I know. And like, it is sort of this weird, like, living scrapbook in the studio, especially where there's like, you know, there's like a paint splotch or a thing where they're like, there's a thing where, like, Chris Farley used to hit his head all the time. And they're like, this is where he, like, there's a sign that says, like, watch your head. And then he, like, wrote his own name so he would remember. And so, like, every time I'm there, I'm like, oh, my God, you know.
Oh, hit his head by accident. For a second, I thought that he would just come off stage and whack his head.
No. It's just, like, a really low-hanging beam that, like, you kind of have to be careful of. But I don't know. There's stuff like that all around that – or, like, we did a shoot recently where we had to wear, like, old kind of, like, 80s style, like, white puffy sneakers, and the ones I was given said, like, David Spade on the inside.
Oh,
and
shit.
Like, stuff like that. Or, like, I've worn loafers that say, like, Molly Shannon on the inside. And, like, because, you know, they just recycle so many of the, like,
of course,
costumes and stuff over the years. They have an incredible archive that's, like, I think I drive the costume people insane because I'm always like, what's this from? Who wore this? A lot of times they're like, we bought it today, you loser. Like,
what if they're like, fuck, just write Julia Louis-Dreyfus in the shoe and just shut her up.
I know. But I'm always like making them go through and stuff. It's the best.
And was your boyfriend at the time cool?
No, he wasn't
cool. I talked to my boyfriend at the time this morning. And
I know. Why did I say that? Yeah, he was the best. I wish he was with me now. No, he is. But yeah, he was the best. And it was kind of perfect because weirdly, shortly after I got hired, he was like in the Just for Laughs Montreal showcase, and then Seth Meyers saw him and was like, I'm obsessed with this guy. So he got hired to like write and work for Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Well, literally next door.
Literally on the same floor. So it really was like a weird romantic workplace for me.
That's fantastic.
No, it was really cool. It was like 3 years he worked there, and it was kind of the best.
And so do you find that, because, you know, I feel like dating another comedy person definitely has pros and cons. Because
yeah.
It's a difficult lifestyle and mentality to explain to someone who, for lack of a better term, just works a regular job.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I feel like a lot of the insecurities or the anxieties can sometimes butt heads.
Yeah.
When you're both kind of going through maybe a little bit of a comedy crisis.
Totally. Well, also I feel like so much of comedy is like high highs and low lows where you're like, I'm killing it. And then the next day you're like, I'm garbage. And like, you know, definitely when you're both on a low low or a high high, it's like, whoa, we're flying too close to the sun right now.
Right.
But no, I mean, like for us, it's been, I think, like, one of the greatest parts of our relationship because before we were working comedy people with comedy money, we were, like, you know, I was in college and I was working at a barbershop sweeping up men's hair, and, like, he was working for 1-800-GOT-JUNK, like, cleaning out hoarders' houses. And so the fact that we've gotten to, like, go on this journey together, truly, like, bottom to top, is like a dream come true, you know?
He must have shared a great junk story.
Oh, I mean, he has a million junk stories. And also we, like, at that time, we had, like, no money, so we furnished our home in, like, other people's junk. 100%. Like, everything we owned was, like, this was a hoarder's typewriter. Like, this armchair belonged to a dead woman. You know?
They lifted it off her when all of her stuff collapsed on
her. I know. So that, like, but we had the coolest stuff because it was all
of like a Vesuvian almost pose.
Truly,
underneath the pile of stuff.
But so, yeah, it was kind of the best. But it was also, I think, the lowest point in his life. What? Not really, but he definitely was like, oh, my God, I can't do this much longer. He was going to the, like, Chicago dump, like, every day, which don't go there.
Don't go there if you don't have
it's
to.
It's bad.
It's not a great. I'm no. sure it's not a great place. What was the first thing? What was your? What would you say was your first indulgence when you realized, like, because that moment that, you know, when you get your first, like, real job,
yeah,
and you've had it for a bit, you kind of have an epiphany. I don't feel like it necessarily always happens right away, but you'll have an epiphany where you go, wait a minute, I think I could pretty much buy anything I want. Yeah. And I could eat at any restaurant. I mean, within reason.
No, right? Totally. But you're like,
I could buy any pair of shoes. Like, you sort of, you get this weird rush of empowerment. It's dangerous because you don't want to just all of a sudden go on a, blow all of your money.
No, but there is like a horny moment where you're like, I've got money. And like, it makes you feel like a horrible villain, but it also is like the most intoxicating, like, haunting experience. I mean, I can think of a first moment for me, but it wasn't, I wasn't really at SNL. Connor, my boyfriend at the time, and myself, we worked, Second City had these contracts on cruise ships. So you would go and perform Second City comedy for 4 months on a cruise ship.
Yep.
And we went and did one of those. And then when we came back, I had money for the first time ever. And I was like, I'm going to buy a car. And I just felt, it was like some kind of like Honda little piece of junk car that I got, but I truly was like, I am Queen Latifah. I'm the richest woman on earth. I am like, I felt insane from it. And I was like, I can't believe like performing comedy for sunburned people like in the Bahamas got me this car.
With
I like couldn't
shrimp cocktail food poisoning.
100%. I like was like, I am so cool that this is a comedy car I drive in, you know?
But that's a good, you know, but that's an acceptable thing. Like a lot of people need a car to get from Twitter. Was there like a thing that you were ashamed that you bought, like a dumb thing?
Ooh,
or just like an indulgence?
I'm trying to think. I mean, I don't know. I can't think of... I'm like... I guess I'm a dumb weenie. I need to start indulging.
You dumb weenie for saving your money and being a responsible citizen?
I know. No. I mean, I'm trying to think. You know, I feel like I just probably was like buying clothes in a way that was like... I felt like I was like from Clueless or something.
Right.
I was like just trying to be like a little fashion queen or something. But I can't think of anything. I wish I was like a Lamborghini, Chris.
No, but it'd be something like, you know, a solid gold parrot or some kind of.
That's what you would buy.
That's what. Hey, now that you mention
you
it.
You gotta.
Wait, so this parrot, is he a living solid gold parrot or is he.
Oh. I assumed he was, like, he died petrified and he was dipped in gold.
Do you think he was dipped in gold? Or he flew through a gold waterfall and then just, like...
Oh.
Or he's, like, the little... You're probably too young to remember this movie, but he's, like, the little mechanical owl from Clash of the Titans.
Yes, I know. I know of this owl.
You do?
Yes.
How do you know of Bubo the mechanical owl?
Okay, well, I didn't know his name.
Okay, well, fine. Maybe I know some things that aren't useful.
I went to a very religious high school, and weirdly, I feel like in some religion class, they were like, we're going to show you Clash of the Titans.
As education?
I guess. I don't know.
Isn't it kind of funny? Because I went to Catholic school, too, and it's so... I don't know if you went to Catholic school.
Yeah, no, it was Catholic school. What if I went to some weird, just like, future Christian school? But no, it was Catholic school.
It's so my Catholic school at the time was this... But we did study mythology, and I really had a difficult time, and they never really fully explained, because I would have mythology... And then a theology class, and they would tell us a bunch of things like, well, at one time, people believed that there were gods who would oversee your garden, and so they dealt with the prosperity of the garden, and that's all bullshit. But
meanwhile,
there's a guy who made wine out of what, you know, it's like,
totally.
They go, but wait, how is that? And they go, because it just is. Fucking shut up about
it. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, it's just the way it is. I go, yeah, but... How do we know that someday people won't look back on this the way that we look back on ancient mythology and go, well, no, because now we've discovered the truth and they didn't know it then. Like, but doesn't that seem...
I know. I have that all the time where I'm like, so the water is holy. That's that water is. But this in my cup is just normal water. I'm like, what is this?
We just had a story on At Midnight about how the Vatican was saying that... This story is annoying for so many reasons, but it has to do with gluten intolerance and communion wafers.
Oh, no.
And about... That's the appropriate reaction. Where it's like... I guess some people wanted gluten-free communion wafers, but the church is saying, no, it can only be low gluten, but there has to be a certain amount of wheat in it, but it's because of transubstantiation. Because it's the body of Christ. I mean, it's just that this whole...
It actually makes me like, we're in hell. Like, we live in hell
this
now.
Is it. We are in it now.
We don't know it, but we are.
Yes. Can I just have, like, avocado toast for my communion? Can you just bless that?
Come on.
What's special about these little pieces of flatbread? Why couldn't you just bless some avocado toast?
For real.
And throw a little holy cheese on there?
I mean, and get me an Australian girlfriend from the 90s. Come on. I can just imagine you in the 90s cruising around with that Sheila.
Oh, that Sheila.
I can't do an Australian accent. That's, I shouldn't have tried to dip it. You're doing Sheila. Really good, though.
I just tried to copy her. Well, she was trying to shed her Australian accent. I was trying to learn how to do
it. Someone told me at SNL once, they were like, if you say Jennifer Lopez, it like... is a really good way to, like, get into the accent. That it weirdly has, like, all the sounds that you want to, like, pull you into the Australian accent. And it does kind of work.
It does have every, like, consonant and phonetic sound.
That, like, helps. I know. I feel like Nassim Pedrad told me that, so shout out to Nassim.
That's amazing.
I know. Isn't that good?
That's I'm absolutely going to use. Yeah, because there's a bunch of little sound tricks like that. Like if you want a friend of mine who does a lot of voiceover ADR and voiceover work said if you want to sound like a recording is running backwards, you say the words turnip and Brezhnev. So you go, turnip, Brezhnev, turnip, Brezhnev, Brezhnev, turnip. And it's that.
Wow. Hot tip.
Some hot tips for
you're
in a situation. Wait a minute. How would I say Jennifer Lopez in an Australian accent backwards?
It.
You couldn't do it.
No, you can't. It wouldn't it's be possible. It's a mess.
I also want to thank you for doing Danger and Eggs.
Well, thank you for... I guess you're my boss.
Well, technically, I guess that's true. But it, you know, but Danger and Eggs is really... It is a shatty Petoskey.
I love it.
And you're so great on it. And the show's so much fun.
Thanks.
And so... I really think the show is important right now.
I know that you and I are probably the two most biased people to be sitting here talking about this show, but like, I really do believe it is like a light in darkness in this time.
Yeah.
You know, it's so, there are so many messages in the show that aren't heavy-handed, that are like very still presented in a fun, delightful way, but that are like things that I was a child.
That's interesting.
But I would have loved to have heard things about like, you know, hear things like identity takes time or things like messages like that, you know, that are good for any child to hear or any adult to hear.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know. I just think it's such... It's also just like a very positive, delightful show.
Yeah, it's positive and it's delightful and it's inclusive and... And she's a great character.
Yeah.
And I love Philip too, because I think most people probably want to be a Dee Dee, but are probably really a little bit of a Philip.
I know that I am.
And so it's a nice, it's like the sort of perfect counterbalance of, you know, of trying to find the perfect midpoint between these two characters.
Totally. And that's kind of what their friendship is, which I think is like a nice lesson. You know, there's balance there. So I just love it. I feel like I'm a freak about it because I'm obviously like doing stuff to actually promote it, like doing weird appearances or whatever. But I also like in my day-to-day life keeping like, have you watched it? In a way that's like, I think, very stressful to the people around me. But I'm like, have you gotten to this episode or that one? I just like love it.
But when people ask me who it's for, I go, well, it's a, you know, it's like a, it is technically a kids show.
Right.
It's through Amazon Kids. But it has that same sort of SpongeBob tonality.
Totally.
That there are, you know, layers of adult that you could, anyone, any age group could relate to it, and on some, there's a stratified layer for everybody.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, I like hate to watch myself or listen to myself in any way because it just is stressful. But weirdly, I could sit down and I watched every episode of this show, like, so truly like a binge watch, because I was just like, this is the bomb.
Yeah.
I don't know. I love it so much.
And Shadi's great, too. And I've known her forever.
You have?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've known Shadi a long time. And I only came into Puny a couple of years ago.
Oh, really?
We had been friends before that. And then one of their partners wanted to just stay in Minnesota and not really be in animation anymore. And
yeah.
Shadi said, do you want to be a partner in the company? And I always wanted to make cartoons. So, yeah. So
You made it.
I got to do it. But I say I got to do it. I did almost literally nothing for this show other than do like one voice for one character. But Shadi really, like, Shadi and her team really, really
she, did like, an incredible blew me job. Away. It's the best.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Now, are you out in Los Angeles promoting that, or are you promoting something, or were you doing something else?
No, I've been kind of in and out of L.A. doing promotion for that and for The Big Sick, but yeah.
I'm my God, of course. Yes. Great job in that movie, by the way. I completely forgot to mention.
That response was too large and too sweet.
No, because I just feel dumb that I literally just saw it because Kumail and Emily were over, I don't know, about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, cool.
And I was gushing at them about how much I love the movie.
It's so good.
It's great. And also, I feel like it does a great job of capturing between, like, you and Kurt and Bo and Kumail, like, the interaction of comedians, you know, like, of just forming this weird little dysfunctional family and shitting on each other in a loving way, fairly nonstop.
Totally. And just like, I don't know, I feel like so much of my 7 years in Chicago, like, doing comedy was just like hanging out.
Right.
You know? And I feel like it captures that in like a really nice way. But I mean, that's like such a small part of the film. I feel like all the stuff with Kumail's family and the parents, like Ray Romano and Holly Hunter, it's, I mean, and Zoe Kazan is brilliant. It's like, I think it's so good. Am I bragging now?
No, not at all, because it, you know what, it's Catholic guilt. Because I feel like, don't ever hold your head up too high.
I know.
But I do think that I'm enjoying seeing that it's gaining momentum.
Totally.
And I see it's like the release is expanded.
I know,
I see the ads for it all the time.
Me too.
And so it's really exciting to see
that. I know,
that.
It's freaking cool.
It is cool. Although it is still surreal for me to see someone doing Emily.
I know.
Like, to see someone doing a character of Emily is so surreal. I mean, Zoe was great.
Yeah.
But when it's someone that you're really, really close friends with, and you're like, oh my God, she picked up on this weird little mannerism that I never really, but that's what she does.
I know. It's so weird. You know, I had that with Chris Kelly. He's one of the head writers of SNL, and he made this movie, Other People. And Jesse Plemons plays a version of Chris Kelly. And there were so many little things that I noticed where I was like, oh my God, that is my friend who I write with every day. It like blew me away. It was really wild.
And Jesse Plemons is also an incredible actor.
Well, which is why it was like literally bone chilling to watch him like transform into my friend, because I was like, everything, like to his posture and like the way he bit his nails and stuff, I was like, that is my homie. That is wild.
It almost makes you think, like, I think he might be a serial killer.
Yes.
Because how did he notice all of this?
Well, also, like, I spend so much time with Chris, but I'd never really noticed those things. But then when I see someone else doing them, I'm like, oh, I guess that is what he does.
Chris, I don't know how to break this to you, but Jesse Plemons is kind of a better you than you, and so we're going to be friends now.
He's teaching me about you.
I think you should talk to him to learn about yourself. I feel like that would – is that ever an improv or sketch exercise where someone else does a character of you back at you?
Oh, I feel like definitely that is, right? Or something like that. I feel like I've been involved in stuff like that. Or I've done an exercise where, like, you're supposed to, like, play the biggest asshole you know. Like, you should go on stage and, like, think of the worst person you know who you hated so much and, like, be that person.
Just as a general rule or just
or just, like, to try, character? Like, yeah, to try one time or something.
Oh, my God. That's a great exercise.
I know. Because then you really get down to the core of, like, what is it that bugs me about that person?
Well, not only that, but I think when you do exercises that force you to think in superlatives, it shaves off a lot of confusion because you instantly kind of know what your motivation is.
Totally.
So if you're the... So sometimes I heard that if a band is stuck writing a song, sometimes they will write essentially like the hackiest thing they can think of.
Yeah.
The hackiest, most in their minds, the most watered down piece of shit, you know, mainstream thing.
Totally.
And then what ends up happening is they always kind of automatically discount the fact that they have a natural filter that will help actually kind of make – but it's just a way to – lower your shields and prejudices so that you can just kind of make something.
Totally. Also, like, I feel like sometimes I get so burnt out where I'm like, nothing's funny anymore and I can't do this.
I told all the jokes. There's no jokes left.
I'm done. But then, you know, you start to think about it in terms of, like, people you know or people you've encountered and you're like, oh, there's an endless supply of stuff.
Well, you're going
out
back
there.
In September?
Yeah.
So you still got a couple months. You'll go back refreshed. Are you doing any other movies or anything over the summer?
No, I'm kind of just chilling. I'm like trying to write a little bit and just hanging.
Good. That's great.
I think so too. I've done a lot of press over the last 2 months, so I'm kind of ready for a little chill time. You
yeah, because I would imagine the SNL schedule is...
A living nightmare? Yeah. I mean, no, it's like a dream, so and the adrenaline like gets you through it, but it is. It's very, very intense.
I mean, I feel like I like to remind people of this a lot because I don't want it to be lost on them. When people have accepted something and the cast, you know, and whoever's making it makes it look easy to do, I think people just take it for granted.
Yeah,
but it should never be lost on people that every fucking week you are writing a brand new and performing a brand new 90-minute, well, you know.
Yeah, give or take.
90 minutes with commercials, yeah. But 90 minutes sketch comedy show about shit that mostly has happened that week.
Yeah.
For the first, you know, basically for the first time.
Totally.
Your show is almost your work. I know you do a practice show, but essentially your show is your workshop and then it's done.
Yeah.
That's an incredible feat.
Well, you know, the thing that I always think about, too, is, like, so, you know, we don't work Sunday. Monday, we come in for, like, 2 hours. So it basically happens all Tuesday to Saturday.
Right.
Which is, like, that's zero time. That's that's nothing, yeah. You know? Like, I've, like, had the stomach flu that long. I'm sorry I'm always talking about, like, releasing.
Are you okay?
I'm fine.
There's a lot of diarrhea.
I know. I'm sorry. Why am I – but – you know what I mean? Where it's like, it's so fast. That's like the blink of an eye. And a lot of times, like, I think of certain costumes that they've made or, I mean, like when Hurricane Sandy happened, they were like borrowing costumes from the Met because they couldn't get out of Manhattan.
Right.
And I mean, stuff like that that's like incredible and insane, you know? But it's like kind of the magic of SNL.
Are you already thinking about characters you want to bring in for the fall, or are you just putting that off until later?
You know, it's like whenever you do that, that stuff never works in a weird way. Like you almost have to take it a week at a time and just go off what's topical or what's happening or what's kind of in the world. Also, I always feel like meeting the host on Monday, you get their vibe and their energy and you kind of are like, oh, I could see them doing this or that. And that really helps because you really have to – really, the show is about them, and so you want to, like, make them look good. And so it's hard to, like, brainstorm over the summer or whatever.
Do you ever go study people in, like, Central Park? Although I'm hesitant to go too far into that because I feel like the classic – this is the classic red flag line. This is the sociopath meter. When someone says to you in kind of an arrogant tone – I just like to people watch.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
to me is like, you're a fucking sociopath.
Yeah.
You think you're better than everyone and you're a sociopath and you think the world is a zoo for you.
Totally.
And fuck you. You know, like,
yes.
But it does seem like if you went to a place that had a lot of different types of people.
Yeah.
But it also feels creepy and stalky.
I mean, it's weird. I feel like I draw more like from like stuff that I experienced myself like as a child or something, or like an insane teacher I had, or someone who an insane friend I had that, like, at the time I was like, this is my best friend. And now looking back, I'm like, that was an insane, like, 8-year-old who tormented me. And now I'm going to put that in a sketch, you know, or that kind of thing. So
revenge.
I love to get revenge, and that's what I'm here for.
Well, I was just reading an article about, because something that comes up on the podcast a lot is that, you know, I have this idea that around the time your hormones kick in when you're a teenager is really when you form your identity that becomes your identity for the rest of your life.
I'm so with that.
And that's why you always are trying to make up for whatever that kid went through. And you're always that kid in your head.
Yeah.
And so someone sent me this article, and some social scientists tied it to the idea of popularity and how much being popular or not being popular affects and informs the rest of your life and what you respond to and how you engage in social situations. And said that, you know, the rates of anxiety and depression are higher for people who did not experience popularity, but people who did experience popularity, it didn't necessarily mean that people liked them, but just, so there is actually a subset of people who are popular, but still kind of felt unliked. However, I feel like if I had been popular in school, I never would have really sought out comedy. I never would have really tried to achieve anything.
Places.
I never would have, you know, gone inward to try to discover anything about myself. So did you?
I feel like you must have been popular. You're like the coolest, smoothest, cool guy of all time.
Not at all. I was completely socially ostracized. I did not have many friends. I had like a couple friends who also were in chess club and who played D&D and video games and stuff.
Yeah.
And I did not fit well or like other kids very much. I found them to be shallow and dickish.
Yeah.
And I hated them. what was your friend structure?
I mean, I had a couple very close friends in high school. And then I would say I was like friendly with everyone. But I never, I mean, like I said, I went to like a super, super Catholic high school that was like, we wore uniforms and it was super strict. And I just feel like I was constantly getting the message of like, you're bad, you're gonna get in trouble, and meanwhile I'm like getting straight A's and like have never left my house,
right.
You know?
Right.
But there was like always this constant, like I would get detentions for the dumbest reasons, and I feel like that like brought out this like anger in me. Like I got a detention once for wearing a toe ring. Now it was the early 2000s, so that was very cool at the time, but like I got like a 45 minute detention for wearing a silver toe ring. And like, you know, those kind of things like made me insane, and so I had a real like rise above kind of like attitude,
right?
Where I was just like mad. But I guess I don't know. I mean, I did like student council and stuff, which I do feel like now looking back, I'm like, that's a popularity contest in like a nasty way.
It really is.
You know, because it's not like we were like exacting any change or anything, like, you know.
We changed the font on the lunchroom sign.
Yeah.
You guys, we did it.
Well, also, I fully did it because our announcements we did over TV. So I ran to like have the position of the person who did the announcements, which was just like my constant quest for like attention.
So you were always comedy savvy.
Yeah. I mean, not really. I started really early doing improv in a weird way. Like I was like 14 or 15 when I found like long form improv, because I found this like kind of teen improv troupe. And like right away I was like, oh, this is so much more fun than like doing a play or something.
Right.
I was like, I get to make up my own shit. And like, and also like I was doing improv with like 11 and 12 year olds and I was like 15. And so I was like, I'm a fucking genius. I like literally was like, I'm so good at this and these people suck. And I was like, yeah, they're like in elementary school, but it gave me like a false confidence where I was like, these people don't even know. Like, you know, in high school, I was like, these people don't even know I like do this cool thing, which is a dork thing. But,
right.
You know, it like gave me a little sense of personal power, I think, where I was like, I'm good at this thing and I'm going to keep doing it. And that's why I want to go to Chicago. And, you know.
Yeah, it is sort of a fun secret thing that I'm sure that, you know, people are like, yeah, in my spare time, I make leather holsters for my
guns.
No.
Oh.
I was going to say.
I was like, holy
they'll
shit.
They'll pay. Someday they'll all pay. I was going more in the, I'll tell you what was in my head so you can see where I was going, that it was not guns. It was basically like sheaths for swords like at Renaissance Fair. That's where
that
I was going.
That sounds more charming. I'm sorry I went right to like, I make leather holsters.
By the way, I'm sorry I didn't yes and that, because that could have gone in a really fun direction, but I wanted to make it very clear very fast that that was never any part of my
MO.
No,
that's not a fun direction.
That is
Let's
not a fun direction.
Stay away from there.
So if you could kill anyone from your high school, like, in order.
Great. This is what I came for. I said we were going to rip it up, and we finally got there.
You know what I think is good, though? I think it's actually good. I think some of that high school and grade school pain is really good, and because I think there's, there can be a healthy amount of motivation behind it. With
totally.
That, if you don't obsess on it and
yeah.
let it ruin your life, but just sort of use it as fuel for every time you get down about something and you think about people who were shitty to you, you're like, I'm going to show them.
Yeah.
Even if you can just use that to motivate and push through, I think is can be healthy.
Yeah, and I also feel like a lot of my, like, even elementary and middle and high school experience, I almost feel like I was, like, outside of myself. Like, I was a 30-year-old woman who also had to do 8th grade or something. So, like, even though I was, like, in 8th grade, I was like, this is a silly situation. And, like, I look forward to being 30 someday, you know? And I do feel like that's, like, how I kind of got through often, was just being like, this isn't my life. This is a little time that I'm in right now.
Oh,
you know?
A pop quiz. How quaint.
Oh, vocabulary. I'm charmed. I look forward to doing my taxes very soon.
Not a bad character, by the way. It's the 30-year-old woman
oh
in 8th grade. The 30-year-old woman in 8th grade.
Check it out in September, everybody.
Who thinks she's 30, but she's still in 8th grade.
Come on.
I'm telling you.
It's not a bad idea.
What's her name? Does she have a name?
Oh, definitely. Like probably like Diane Shapiro or something. The least 8th grade name you've ever heard. It's like hyphenated or something.
Diane Shapiro Dwyer, yeah. That's really fucking funny. Anyway, I hope that happens.
I really hope that. Thank you.
That's all right. When you're accepting the Emmy.
Good.
Don't thank anyone else.
No, I only can thank myself.
You can thank yourself.
I think me and only me, I'm gorgeous and I've been doing good for a long time.
Thank your boyfriend at the time.
That was truly like, that was, I hope that wasn't like wishful thinking that like came out in some like nasty way where I was like, he's gone to me now.
I have a couple of feet out the door. No, I think it makes sense because you were speaking in context.
Yes, it was a long time ago. Well, also now we're engaged, so now he's something
Congratulations.
Different. He's a fiance.
He's your fiance at the time.
He was a boyfriend at the time.
When are you guys getting married?
I don't know. Yeah. I'm like so bad I haven't done anything, so.
Yeah,
I guess never.
I know. Well, I was very lucky because when Lydia and I got engaged and, you know, she said, hey, and I did not ask for this. She offered. She was like, you know, I'm gonna make this really easy for you. You can basically pretty much just show up. And I was like, I want to help
yeah.
you realize that dream.
That's so good.
And so she did an amazing job. And so that was all. I feel like if it was up to me, I'd be like, I don't know. Who do we invite? You know, like,
yeah,
I'm bad about all that stuff.
I know. Me too. I'm not someone who, like, my whole life has been like, my bridal day, like.
I can't wait to be a bridezilla.
Yeah, totally. So we'll see.
Well, let me just pitch something to you.
Please.
Pitch your wedding as a sketch. so you do it on the show, and the show pays for it, and then you wear like a wedding dress that Jan Hooks wore in a sketch. And it's a sketch of a wedding, so they plan it all. And then you actually do get like someone who's ever the guest host is actually, or you get them ordained, and then they actually marry you. So it's real.
I think what you just described is actually like my worst nightmare. That like when I close my eyes and see like a hell scenario wedding, that's what it is. Where I'm like, and musical guest. Like,
musical guest, Katy Perry.
But I'm open-minded.
All right, good, good. I just want to make sure. Well, this was an hour already. We've already blazed through an hour.
It was so fun. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad we got a chance to sit down and talk because I'm a fan of you and your comedy.
I'm a fan of you.
And it was really fun to hang out a little bit at the Danger and Eggs party, but everyone was running around.
It was a hot party scene.
It was a hot party scene at El Cid's down on West Sunset Boulevard.
This was the best.
And you and Lydia realized that you had met each other at a Christian Siriano
show. I know. How wild was that? I was truly like, I know this woman.
Yeah, you both had that moment. I know you. Where did we meet?
But you know what? It's like, I don't know. Sometimes those things, I'm like, I don't belong at a fashion show. So I feel very like out of my body. And so it was nice to see a friendly face.
That's nice. Well, and if you're ever in an event again, I mean, Lydia, it's like we're terrible. We do go to some events, but we're always the people in the corner going, I don't think we belong here.
Yes, that's me. I'm like, where are the snacks? And I need to go.
I like to think that everyone feels that way, but I don't think that's true.
Yeah. I know.
So the trick is just to find other people. If I see a comedy person at a party, if I see you at a party.
Great.
That we're hanging out because.
You're my safe space.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. We'll just go people watch.
You know, I'm just an honest person.
Oh, God.
I'm just honest. I just people watch. Fuck you.
But thank you so much for being here, Eddie Bryan. It's an absolute pleasure. The Big Sick, people can see. It is expanded. Danger and Eggs is on Amazon Prime. You can watch it. And SNL comes back in September.
Yeah.
And thanks to Jennifer Lopez.
Thank you, Jennifer Lopez.
He's great, Jennifer Lopez. You're still Jenny on the block. I feel like I'm doing a little more New Zealand than Australian.
I know.
New Zealand goes up a bit.
I can't do any accent, and that's why I'm the worst SNL cast member of all time.
Gina, you know, I feel like the way to try to lock into the Kiwi accent is just to do Jermaine saying Brett's name. Brit.
That's a good hot tip, too.
Brit. Yeah.
This is a dialogue podcast. Dialect. I said dialogue.
Using dialect in your dialogue podcast.
Please buy our DVD.
Don't get diarrhea while doing dialect with your dialogue.
Wow.
All right.
You really wrapped it up.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.